voices, so her chosen perch would warm up a bit. Leaving the TV off, he returned to the kitchen. Melanie was still sitting at the table, as animated as a carrot. Laura was at the counter where Earl had left her, still holding a knife. She didn't seem to have been working on dinner while he'd been gone. She'd just been waiting, knife in hand, in case someone else returned in Earl's place. She was obviously relieved when she saw him, and she put the knife down. "Well?" "Nothing." The refrigerator door suddenly came open of its own volition. The jars, bottles, and other items on the glass shelves began to wobble and rattle. As though touched by invisible hands, several cupboard doors flew open. Laura gasped. Instinctively, Earl reached for the gun in his holster, but he had no one to shoot at. He stopped with his hand on the butt of the weapon, feeling slightly foolish and more than a little perplexed. Dishes jiggled and clattered on the shelves. A calendar hanging on the wall by the back door fell to the floor with a sound like frantic wings. After 10 or 15 seconds, which seemed like an hour, the dishes stopped rattling, and the cupboard doors stopped swinging on their hinges, and the contents of the refrigerator grew still. "Earthquake," Earl said.
"Was it?"
Laura McCaffrey said doubtfully. He knew what she meant. It had been similar to the effects of a moderate earthquake, yet somehow different. An odd pressure change had seemed to condense the air, and the sudden chill had been too harsh to be attributed entirely to the open refrigerator door. In fact, when the trembling stopped, the air warmed up in an instant, even though the refrigerator door was still open. But, if not a quake, what had it been? Not a sonic boom? That wouldn't explain the chill or the pressure in the air. Not a ghost. He didn't believe in ghosts. And where the hell had such a thought come from, anyway? He'd run Poltergeist on his VCR a couple nights ago. Maybe that was it. But he was not so impressionable that one good scary movie would make him reach for a supernatural explanation here, now, when a considerably less exotic answer was so evident. "Just an earthquake," he assured her. Although he was far from convinced of that. They figured he was Joseph Scaldone, the owner, because all the paper in his wallet was for Scaldone. But until they got a dental records confirmation or a fingerprint match, the wallet was the only way they could peg him. No one who knew Scaldone would be able to make a visual identification, because the poor bastard didn't have a face left. There wasn't even much hope of getting an ID based on scars or on other identifying marks, because the body was smashed and torn and flayed and gouged so badly that old scars or birthmarks were lost in the bloody ruins. Splintered ribs poked up through holes in his shirt, and a jagged lance of bone had pierced both his leg and trousers. He looked squashed. Turning from the body, Dan encountered a man whose biological clock seemed to be suffering from chronological confusion. The guy had the smooth, unlined, wide-open face of a 30-year-old, the graying hair of a 50-year-old, and the age-rounded shoulders of a retiree. He wore a well-cut dark blue suit, a white shirt, a dark blue tie, and a gold tie chain instead of a clip or tack. He said, "You're Al Dane?"
"That's right."
"Michael Seams, FBI." They shook hands. Seams's hand was cold and clammy. They moved away from the corpse into a corner that was clear of debris.
"Are you guys on this one now?" Dan asked.
"Don't worry, we aren't pushing you out of it," Seams assured him diplomatically. "We just want to be part of it, just observers, for the time being."
"Good," Dan said bluntly.
"I've talked to everyone else working on the case, so I just wanted to tell you what I've told them. Please keep me informed. Any development at all, no matter how unimportant it seems, I want to be informed."
"But what justification does the FBI have for stepping into this at all?"
"Justification?" Seams's face creased with a pained smile. "Whose side are you on, Lieutenant?"
"I mean, what federal statutes have been broken?"
"Let's just say it's a national security matter."
In the middle of his young face, Seams's eyes were old, ancient, and watchful.
They were like the eyes of a reptilian hunter that had been around since the Mesozoic era and knew all the tricks. Dan said, "Hafritz used her work for the Pentagon. Did research for them."
"That's right."
"Was he doing defense research when he was killed?"
"No."
The agent's voice was flat, without emotion or inflection, and Dan couldn't be sure if he was lying or telling the truth.
"McCaffrey?" Dan asked. "Was he doing defense-type research?"
"Not for us," Seams said. "At least not lately."
"For someone else?"
"Maybe."
"Russians?"
"More likely to be Iraq or Libya, or Iran these days."
"You're saying it was one of them who financed him?"
"I'm saying no such thing. We don't know,"
Seams claimed in that same bland voice that might easily conceal deception.
"That's why we want in on this. McCaffrey was on a Pentagon-funded project when he disappeared 6 years ago with his daughter. We investigated him back then at the request of the Defense Department and decided he hadn't run off with any new valuable information related to his research. We figured it was nothing more than what it seemed to be, entirely a personal matter having to do with a nasty child custody dispute."
"Maybe it was."
"Yes, maybe it was," Seams said. "At first, anyway. But after a while, McCaffrey apparently got involved in something important. Maybe something dangerous. At least, that's certainly how it seems when you get a look at that gray room in Studio City. As for Willie Hafritz, 18 months after McCaffrey disappeared, Hafritz finished a long-running Pentagon project and declined to accept any additional defense-related work. He said that kind of research had begun to bother his conscience. At the time, the military tried to persuade him to change his mind, but eventually they accepted his refusal."
"From what I know of him," Dan said, "I don't believe Hafritz had a conscience." Seams's penetrating, hawkish eyes never left Dan's. He said,
"You're right about that, I think. At the time Hafritz did his mea culpa routine, the Defense Department didn't ask us to verify his sudden turn toward pacifism. They accepted it at face value, but today, I've been looking more closely at Willie Hafritz. I'm convinced he stopped taking Pentagon grants only because he no longer wanted to be subject to random periodic security investigations. He didn't want to worry that anyone might be watching him. He needed anonymity for some project of his own."
"Like torturing a 9-year-old girl," Dan said.
"Yes. I was in Studio City a few hours ago. Had a look at that house. Nasty."
Neither the expression on his face nor that in his eyes matched the distaste and disapproval in his voice. Judging from his eyes, in fact, one might suspect that Michael Seams found the gray room more interesting than repulsive. Dan said,
"Why do you think they were doing those things to Melanie McCaffrey?"
"I don't know."
"Bizarre stuff," Seams said,
wide-eyed, shaking his head with amazement. But his sudden expression of innocence seemed calculated.
"What effect were they trying to obtain?"
"I don't know."
"They weren't just involved in behavior modification studies at that house."
Seams shrugged. Dan said,
"They were into brainwashing, total mind control, and something else. Something worse."
Seams appeared to be bored. His gaze drifted away from Dan, and he watched the SID technicians as they sifted through the blood-spattered rubble. Dan said,
"But why?"
"I really don't know,"
Seams said again, impatiently this time.
"I only—"
"But you're desperate to find out who was funding this whole hellish project," Dan said.
"I wouldn't say desperate. I'd say frantic. Quietly frantic."
"Then you must have some idea of what they were up to. You know something that's making you frantic."
"For Christ's sake, Haldane,"
Seams said angrily, but even his anger seemed calculated. A ruse. Calculated misdirection.
"You've seen the condition of the bodies. Prominent scientists, formerly funded by the Pentagon, wind up murdered in an inexplicable fashion. Hell, of course we're interested."
"Inexplicable?" Dan said. "It's not inexplicable. They were beaten to death."
"Come on, Haldane, it's more complicated than that. If you've talked to your own coroner's office, you've learned they can't figure out what the hell kind of weapon it was. And you've learned the victims never had a chance to fight back, no blood, skin, or hair under their fingernails. And many of the blows couldn't have been struck by a man wielding a club because no man would have the strength to crush another man's bones like that. It would take tremendous force, mechanical force, inhuman force. They weren't just beaten to death. They were smashed, like bugs. And what about the doors here?
Dan frowned. What doors?
Here, this shop. The front and back doors.
What about them?
You don't know?
I just got here. I've hardly talked with anyone.
Seams nervously adjusted his tie, and Dan was unsettled by the sight of a nervous FBI agent. He had never seen one before, and Michael Seams's nervousness was one thing that he didn't appear to be faking.
"The doors were locked when your people arrived," the agent said. "Scaldone had closed up for the day just before he was killed. The back door had probably been locked all along, but just before he was killed, he'd closed the front door, locked it as well, and pulled down the shade. He would most likely have left the place by the rear door, his car's out back, once he'd finished totaling the day's receipts. But he didn't finish. He was hit while the doors were still locked. First officer on the scene had to kick out the lock on the front door."
"So?"
"So only the victim was inside," Seams said. "Both doors were locked when the first cops arrived, but the killer wasn't here with Scaldell."
"What's so amazing about that?"
"It just means the killer must have had a key."
"And paused to lock up after himself when he left?"
"It's possible."
Seams shook his head.
"Not if you know how the doors were locked. In addition to a pair of deadbolts on each, there was a bolt latch. A manually operated bolt latch that could be engaged only from inside the shop."
"Bolt latches on both doors?" Dan asked.
"Yes. And there are only two windows in this shop. The big show window there, which is fixed in place. Nobody could leave that way without first throwing a brick through it. The other window is in the back room, the office. It's a jalousie window for ventilation."
"Big enough for a man?"
"Yes," Seams said. "Except there are bars on the inside of it."
"Bars?"
"Bars."
"Then there must be another way out."
"You find it,"
Seams said in a tone of voice that meant that it couldn't be found.
Dan surveyed the wreckage again, put a hand to his face, as if he might be able to wipe off his weariness, and winced as his fingertips brushed the still sticky wound on his forehead.
"You're telling me Scaldone was beaten to death in a locked room?"
"Killed in a locked room, yes. I'm still not sure about the beaten part."
"And there's no way the killer could have gotten out of here before the first squad car arrived?"
"No way."
"Yet he isn't here now."
"Right."
Seams's too young face seemed to be straining toward a more harmonious relationship with his graying hair and his stooped shoulders. It appeared to have aged a few years in just the past 10 minutes.
"You see why I'm frantic, Lieutenant Haldane? I'm frantic because two top-notch former defense researchers have been killed by persons or forces unknown. By a weapon that can reach through locked doors or solid walls, and against which there seems to be absolutely no defense."
Something about it had been different from an earthquake, but Laura couldn't precisely define the difference. Well, for one thing, she couldn't remember the windows rattling. Although, in an earthquake strong enough to fling open the cupboard doors, the windows would have been thrumming, clattering. She'd had no sense of motion either, no rolling. Of course, if they had been far enough from the epicenter, ground movement wouldn't have been easy to detect. The air had felt strange, oppressive, not stuffy or humid, but charged. She'd been through a number of quakes before, and she didn't remember the air feeling like that. But something else still argued against the earthquake explanation, something important on which she couldn't quite put her finger. Earl returned to the table and newspaper, and Melanie continued to stare down at her hands. Laura finished making the salad. She put it in the refrigerator to chill while the spaghetti was cooking. The water had begun to boil. Steam plumed from it. Laura was just taking the vermicelli out of the Ronzoni box when Earl glanced up from the newspaper and said, "Hey, that explains a cat."
Laura didn't understand.
Huh?
They say animals usually know when an earthquake is coming. They get nervous and act strange. Maybe that's why Pepper got hysterical and chased ghosts all over the kitchen.
Before Laura even had time to consider what Earl had said, the radio clicked on, as if an unseen hand had twisted the knob. Living by herself, as she had for the past 6 years, Laura sometimes found the silence and emptiness of the house to be more than she could bear, and she kept radios in several rooms. The one in the kitchen, by the bread box, only a few feet away from where Laura was standing, was a Sony AM-FM with a clock, and when it snapped on all by itself, it was tuned to KRLA, where she had set the dial the last time that she'd used it. Bonnie Tyler was singing Total Eclipse of the Heart. Earl had put down his paper. He was standing again. Laura stared at the radio in disbelief. Of its own accord, the volume knob began to rotate to the right. She could see it moving. Bonnie Tyler's throaty voice grew louder, louder. Earl said, "What the hell?" Melanie drifted unaware in her private darkness. The voice of Bonnie Tyler and the music enfolding her words now bounced back and forth off the kitchen walls and made the windows rattle in a way that the earthquake hadn't done. Aware that a chill had settled over the room once more, Laura took a step toward the radio. In another part of the house, Pepper was screeching again. As Dan was turning away from Michael Seams, the FBI agent said, "By the way, what happened to your forehead?"
"I was trying on hats," Dan said.
"Hats?"
"I tried on one that was too small for me. Had a hell of a time getting it off. Pulled skin right along with it."
Before Seams could respond, Ross Mondale stepped through a door at the back of the store, behind the sales counter. He spotted Dan and he said,
"Haldane, come here."
"What is it, Chief?"
"I want to talk to you."
"What about, Chief?"
"Alone,"
Mondale said fiercely.
"Be right there, Chief."
He left Seams blinking and puzzled. He picked his way through the wreckage, past the corpse, around the counter. Mondale motioned him through the door back there, then followed him. The rear room was as wide as the store, but only 10 feet deep, with concrete block walls. It doubled as an office and storage area. On the left were piles of boxes, apparently filled with merchandise. On the right were a desk, an IBM PC, a few file cabinets, a small refrigerator, and a work table on which stood a Mr. Coffee machine. No violence had been done there. Everything was neat and orderly. Mondale had been going through the desk drawers. Several items, including a slim little address book, were piled on the blotter. As the captain closed the door, Dan went around behind the desk and sat down.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Mondale asked.
"Taking a load off my feet. It's been a long day."
"You know that's not what I mean."
"Oh?"
As usual, Mondale was wearing a brown suit, light beige shirt, brown tie, brown socks and shoes. His brown eyes seemed to flicker with a murderous light similar to that refracted within his ruby ring.
"I wanted to see you in my office by 2:30.
"I never got your message."
"I know damn well you did."
"No, really, I'd have come running."
"Don't screw with me."
Dan just stared at him. The captain stood several steps from the desk, his neck stiff, his shoulders tense. Arms straight down at his sides, hands flexing and twitching as if he had to struggle to keep from forming them into fists and coming for Haldane.
"What have you been doing all day?"
"Contemplating the meaning of life."
"You were at Rink's place."
"You don't need to be in a church. It's possible to contemplate the meaning of life almost anywhere."
"I didn't send you to Rink's place."
"I'm a full-fledged detective lieutenant. I usually follow my own instincts in an investigation."
"Not in this one. This one's big. In this one, you're just part of the team. You do what I tell you. Go where I tell you. You don't even shit unless I tell you it's okay."
"Careful, Ross. You're beginning to sound power crazy."
"What happened to your head?"
"I've been taking karate lessons."
"What?"
tried to break a board with my head.
Like hell.
Okay, then, what happened was George Padrakis told me you wanted to see me here, and at the mention of your name, I dropped right to my knees and bowed down so fast I scraped my head on the sidewalk. For a moment, Ross couldn't speak. His brown face had flushed. He was breathing hard. Dan more closely examined the items that Mondale had taken from the drawers and piled on the blotter. The address book, a ledger-sized checkbook for an account in the name of the sign of the pentagram, an appointments calendar, and a thick sheaf of invoices. He picked up the address book.
"Put that down and listen to me,"
Mondale said sharply, finally recovering his voice. Dan favored him with a sweet smile of innocence and said,
"But it might contain a clue, Captain. I'm investigating this case, and I wouldn't be doing my job well if I didn't pursue every possible clue."
Mondale came toward the desk, furious. His hands had finally tightened into twin hammers of flesh and bone.
"Ah, at last," Dan thought. "The showdown we've both been wanting for years."
Laura stood in front of the Sony, staring at it, afraid to touch it, shivering in the chilly air. The cold seemed to be radiating from the radio, carried on the pale green light that shone forth from the AM-FM dial. That was a crazy thought. It was a radio, not an air conditioner, not anything, just a radio. An ordinary radio. An ordinary radio that had turned itself on without help from anyone. Bonnie Tyler's song had faded into a new tune. It was a golden oldie, Procol Harum singing A Whiter Shade of Pale. That was at top volume, too. The radio vibrated against the tiled counter on which it stood. The thunderous song reverberated in the windows, hurting Laura's ears. Earl had moved up behind her. If Pepper were still squealing in another part of the house, the cat's voice was lost in the explosively loud music. Hesitantly, Laura put her fingers on the volume knob. Freezing. Shuddering, she nearly snatched her hand away, not simply because the plastic was impossibly cold, but because it was a different kind of coldness from any she'd felt before. A strangeness that chilled not only the flesh, but the mind and soul as well. Nevertheless, she held on to it and tried to reduce the volume, but the knob wouldn't budge. She couldn't turn Procol Harum down, and since the volume control was also the on-off switch, she couldn't shut the music off either. She strained hard, felt the muscles bunching in her arm, but still the knob would not respond. She was shaking. She let go of the knob. Although Whiter Shade of Pale was a melodic and appealing song, it sounded harsh and even curiously ominous at that volume. Each thump of the drums was like the approaching footsteps of some threatening creature, and the wailing of the horns was the same beast's hostile cries. She grabbed the cord of the radio, jerked on it, the plug popped out of the wall socket. The music died. Instantly. She had been half afraid that it would go on playing, even without power. When Dan didn't put down Joseph Scaldone's address book, a pocket-sized booklet, actually. Mondale reached across the desk, clamped his right hand over Dan's right hand, and squeezed hard, trying to make him drop the thing. Mondale was not a tall man, but he was thick in the shoulders and chest. He had powerful arms, out of proportion to the rest of him, thick wrists, big hands. He was strong. Dan was stronger. He didn't let go of the address book. His eyes fixed unwaveringly on Mondale's eyes, and he put his left hand on Mondale's hand and tried to pry the bastard's fingers loose. The situation was ludicrous. They were like a couple of idiot teenagers determined to prove that they were macho. Mondale tried to crush Dan's right hand, and Dan refusing to flinch or in any way reveal his pain while he struggled to free himself. He got a grip on one of Mondale's fingers and began to bend it backward. Mondale's jaw clenched. The muscles popped up, quivering. The finger bent back and back. Mondale resisted that effort even as he attempted to apply a stronger grip to Dan's right hand. But Dan wouldn't relent, and the finger bent back farther, farther. Sweat had appeared on Mondale's brow. "My dog's better than your dog. My mom's prettier than your mom," Dan thought. "Jesus, how old are we anyway? 14? 12?
but he kept his eyes on Mondale's eyes, and he refused to let the captain see that he was hurting. He bent that goddamn finger back farther until he was sure that it would snap, then farther, and abruptly Mondale gasped and let go. Dan remained in possession of the address book. He kept a grip on Mondale's finger for a second or two, long enough so there could be no mistake about who had relented first. The contest had been silly and juvenile, but that was no reason to believe Ross Mondale didn't take it seriously. He was dead serious. And if the captain thought he could teach Dan a lesson with physical force, then perhaps, just perhaps, he could learn a lesson himself by the same method of instruction. They stood in the silent kitchen, staring at the radio. Then Earl said, "How could it—" "I don't know," Laura said. "Has it ever?" "Never." The radio had ceased to be a harmless appliance. Now it was a brooding, menacing presence. Earl said, "Plug it in again." Laura was irrationally afraid that if they brought the radio back to life, it would sprout crab-like legs of plastic and begin to crawl across the counter. That was an uncharacteristically bizarre thought, and she was surprised at herself, startled by the sudden rush of superstitious dread. For she thought of herself as a woman of science, always logical and reasonable. Yet she couldn't shake the feeling that some malignant force was still within the radio, and that it waited eagerly for the plug to be reinserted in the wall socket. Nonsense. Nevertheless, stalling, she said, "Plug it in?" "Why?" "Well," Earl said, "I want to see what it does. We can't just leave it like this. It's too damn weird. We've got to figure it out." Laura knew he was right. Hesitantly, she reached for the cord. She half expected it to wriggle in her hand and feel slimy cold like an eel. But it was only a power cord, lifeless. Nothing unusual about it. She touched the volume control on the radio, and she found that it could be moved now. She twisted it all the way down, clicked it to the off position. With considerable apprehension, she put the plug in the socket again. Nothing. 5 seconds? 10? 15? Earl said, "Well, whatever it was," the radio snapped on. The dial lit up. The air was arctic again. Laura stepped away from the counter, backed toward the table, afraid that the radio would fling itself at her. She stopped beside Melanie and put one hand on the girl's shoulder to reassure her, but Melanie appeared to be as oblivious of these strange events as she was of everything else. The volume dial moved. This time the dial didn't peg out at the top, but stopped halfway. The latest piece of gangster rap crap thumped from the radio. The beat-heavy music was loud, although not unbearable. Another knob spun as if an invisible hand were adjusting it. This one was the frequency selector. The red indicator dot glided fast across the luminous green dial, leaving the rap song behind, flitting rapidly to the right end of the scale, bringing them only flashes of songs, commercials, news reports, and DJ voices on a score of other stations. It reached the end of the radio band and moved back to the left, all the way, then swept to the right again, faster, so that the snatches of various broadcasts blended together in an eerie electronic ululation. Earl moved closer to the Sony. "Careful," Laura said. She realized it was ridiculous to be warning him about a mere radio. It was an inanimate object, for God's sake, not a living creature. She'd owned it for 3 or 4 years. It had brought her music and kept her company. It was only a radio. When Mondale got his hand back, he didn't rub it or even try to flex the pain out of it. Like a simple-minded high school jock with wounded pride, he went right on pretending that he was the toughest. He casually put his hand in his pocket, as if checking for change or keys, and he kept it there. He poked his other hand toward Dan, pointed a finger at him. "Don't you screw this up for me, Haldane. This is an important case. It's going to mean heat, lots of heat. We're going to feel like we're working in a damn furnace. I've got the press nipping at my heels and the FBI in my back, and I've already had calls from the mayor and from Chief Kelsey, wanting results. I don't intend to screw this one up. My career might ride on this one.
I'm keeping control, Haldane. Tight control. I'm not letting some hotshot Lone Ranger type put my ass in a sling for me. If my ass ends up in a sling, it'll be because I put it there. This is a team effort, see, and I'm the captain, and coach, and quarterback, all rolled into one, and anybody who can't play it as a team effort just isn't even going to get on the field. You got me?
So, this wasn't going to be the final showdown after all. Ross was just going to bluster and fume. He felt tough and important when he could point his finger at a subordinate, glower, and chew ass for a while. Dan sighed with some disappointment and leaned back in the office chair, folding his hands behind his head.
"Furnaces, football fields, Ross. You're getting your metaphors mixed up. Face it, old buddy, you'll never be an inspiring speaker. Or a disciplinarian. General Patton, you ain't."
Glaring at him, Mondale said, "At Chief Kelsey's request, I'm putting together a special task force to handle this case, just like they did for the Hillside Strangler business several years back. All assignments come straight from me, and I'm assigning you to a desk at HQ for the duration. You'll coordinate the files on some aspects of the investigation."
"I'm not a desk man."
"Now you are. I'm a deskophobic. You force me to work at a desk, I'll have a complete nervous breakdown. It's going to mean a major workers' compensation claim." "Don't screw with me," Mondale warned again.
"I'm scared of desk blotters, too. And those can-type holders for pencils just spooked the bejesus out of me, so I thought first thing tomorrow I'd start looking into this Freedom Now group, and maybe
Wexler and Manuelo are going to handle that," Mondale said. "They'll also be talking to the head of the psychology department at UCLA, but you will be at your desk, Haldane, at your desk, doing what you're told."
Dan didn't reveal that he had already been to UCLA and that he'd spoken with Ermitrude Heidi Gelkenshettle. He wasn't giving Mondale anything right now. Instead, he said, "Wexlersch is no detective. Hell, he has to paint his pecker bright yellow so he can find it when he has to pee. And Manuelo drinks."
"The hell he does," Mondale said sharply. "He drinks on duty more often than not." "He's an excellent detective," Mondale insisted.
"Your definition of excellent is the same as your definition of obedient. You like Manuelo because he sucks up to you. You're a tremendous self-promoter, Ross, but you're a lousy cop and a worse leader. For your sake, as much as anyone's, I'm going to have to ignore the desk assignment you've given me and play the investigation my own way."
"That's it. You insolent bastard, that's it. You're through. You're finished here. I'll call your boss. I'll call Templeton and have him yank your insubordinate ass back to Central where you belong."
The captain swung away from Dan and started toward the door.
Dan said, "If you make Templeton pull me off this assignment, I'll have to tell him and everyone else about Cindy Lakey."
Mondale stopped with his hand on the doorknob, breathing hard, but he didn't face Dan. To Mondale's back, Dan said, "I'll have to tell them how little Cindy Lakey, that poor little 8-year-old girl, would still be alive today, a young woman now, maybe married with a girl of her own, if it wasn't for you." Laura stayed at Melanie's side, one hand on the girl's shoulder, ready to grab her and run if it came to that. Earl Benton leaned close to the radio and seemed mesmerized by the magically spinning knob and the floating red station selector that whipped back and forth across the lighted dial. Abruptly, the red dot stopped, but only for a moment, only long enough to let a DJ speak one word, "Somethings," and then spun across the dial and stopped again at another frequency. Again, it only dipped into the announcer's patter for a single word, "Coming," then zipped farther along the glowing green band, paused once more, this time plucking one word out of the middle of a song, "Somethings," then spun away to a new station, popped into the middle of an advertisement, "Coming," and swept on down the band again. Laura suddenly realized there was an intelligent purpose to the pauses of the frequency selector. "We're being sent a message," she thought. "Something's coming." But a message from whom? From where? Earl looked at her, and the astonishment on his face made it clear that the same questions were in his mind. She wanted to move, run, get out of here. She could not lift her feet. Her bones had locked at every joint. Her muscles had petrified. The red dot stopped moving for no more than a second, perhaps only a fraction of a second. This time, Laura recognized the tune from which the word was plucked. The Beatles were singing. Before the red dot continued on its way, the single word that came from the radio's speaker was also the title of the song, Something. The selector glided farther along the green-lit band, paused for an instant. Is? It slipped off that station, sped to another. Coming? The air was frigid, but that wasn't the only reason Laura was shivering. Something is coming. Those three words were not merely a message. They were a warning. Without opening it, Mondale had turned away from the door that connected the late Joseph Scaldone's office to the sales room at the sign of the pentagram. He faced Dan again, and both his anger and indignation had given way to a more fundamental emotion. Now his face was carved and his eyes were colored by pure hatred. Dan had mentioned Cindy Lakey for the first time in more than 13 years. This was the dirty secret that they shared, the ever-spreading malignancy at the core of their relationship. Now, having brought it into the open, Dan was exhilarated by the prospect of forcing Mondale to face up to the consequences of his actions at long last. In a low, intense voice, the captain said, "I didn't kill Cindy Lakey, damn it. You allowed it to happen when you could have prevented it." "I'm not God," Mondale said bitterly. "You're a cop. You have responsibilities. You smug bastard. You're sworn to protect the public." "Yeah? Really?" "Well, the fucking public never cries over a dead cop," Mondale said, still speaking softly in spite of his ferocity, guarding this conversation from the ears of those in the nearby shop. "You've also got a duty to stand up for a buddy, to protect your partner's backside." "You sound like some half-baked little Boy Scout," Mondale said scornfully. "Esprit de corps, one for all and all for one, crap. When it gets down to the nitty-gritty, it's always every man for himself, and you know it." Already, Dan wished he had never mentioned Cindy Lakey's name. The exhilaration that had lifted him a moment ago was gone. In fact, his spirits sank lower than they had been. He felt bone-weary. He had intended to make Mondale face up to his responsibilities after all these years. But it was too late. It had always been too late, because Mondale had never been the kind of man who could admit weakness or error. He always slipped out from under his mistakes or found a way to make others pay his penance for him. His record was clean, spotless, and probably would always remain spotless, not just in the eyes of most others, but in his own eyes as well. He couldn't even admit his weaknesses and errors to himself. Ross Mondale was incapable of guilt or self-reproach. Right now, standing before Dan, he clearly felt no responsibility or remorse for what had happened to Cindy Lakey. The only emotion boiling through him now was irrational hatred, directed at his ex-partner. Mondale said, "If anyone was responsible for the death of that girl, it was her own mother." Dan didn't want to continue the battle. He was as weary as a centenarian who had danced away his birthday night. Mondale said, "Crucify her goddamn mother, not me." Dan said nothing. Mondale said, "Her mother was the one who dated Felix Dunbar in the first place." Staring at the captain as if he were a pile of some noxious and not quite identifiable substance found on a city sidewalk, Dan said, "Are you actually telling me Fran Lakey should have known Dunbar was unstable?" "Hell yes. He was a nice guy, by all accounts." "Blew her fucking head off, didn't he?" Mondale said. "Owned his own business, well-dressed, no criminal record, a steady churchgoer. By all appearances, he was a regular upstanding citizen." "Upstanding citizens don't blow people's heads off. Fran Lakey was dating a loser, a creep, a real screwball. From what I heard later, she dated a lot of guys, and most of them were losers. She put her daughter's life in danger, not me." Dan watched Mondale the way he might have watched a particularly ugly bug crawl across a dinner table.
Are you saying she should have been able to see the future? Was she supposed to know that her boyfriend would go off his rocker when she finally broke up with him? Was she supposed to know he would come to her house with a gun and try to kill her and her daughter just because she wouldn't go to a movie with him? If she could see the future that well, Ross, she'd have put every psychic and palm reader and crystal ball gazer out of business. She'd have been famous.
She put her daughter's life in danger, Mondale insisted.
Dan leaned forward, hunching over the desk, lowering his voice further. If she could have seen into the future, she would have known it wouldn't help to call the cops that night. She'd have known you'd be one of the officers answering the call. And she'd have known you'd choke up, and...
I didn't choke up,
Mondale said. He took a step toward the desk, but as a threatening gesture, it was ineffective.
Something's coming.
Fascinated, Earl watched the radio. Laura looked at the door that opened onto the patio and the rear lawn. It was locked. So were the windows. The blinds were drawn. If something did come, where would it come from? And what would it be, for God's sake? What would it be? The radio said, "Watch!" Then, "Out!" Laura fixated on the open door to the dining room. Whatever was coming might already be in the house. Maybe it would come from the living room, through the dining room. The frequency selector stopped again, and a DJ's voice boomed through the speaker. It was swift patter, with no purpose but to fill a few seconds of dead air between tunes. Yet, for Laura, it had an unintended ominous quality.
"Better beware out there, my rock and roll munchkins. Better beware, 'cause it's a strange world, a mean and cold world, with things that go bump in the night, and all you got to protect you is your cousin Frankie, that's me. So if you don't keep that dial where it is, if you change stations now, you better beware. Better be on the lookout for the gnarly old goblins who live under the bed, the ones who fear nothing but the voice of Uncle Frankie. Better look out."
Earl put one hand on top of the radio, and Laura half expected a mouth to open in the plastic and bite off his fingers.
"Cold," he said, as the tuning knob moved toward another station.
Laura shook Melanie. "Honey, come on, get up." The girl didn't stir. One clear word burst from the radio as the tuning knob stopped again in the middle of a news report. "Murder!" Dan wished that he could magically transport himself out of the dreary spook shop office and into Saul's Delicatessen, where he could order a huge Reuben sandwich and drink a few bottles of Beck's Dark. If he couldn't have Saul's, he'd settle for Jack in the Box. If he couldn't have Jack in the Box, then he'd rather be at home, washing the dirty dishes that he had left in the kitchen. Anywhere but in a confrontation with Ross Mondale. Dredging up the past was pointless and depressing. But it was too late to stop now. They had to go through the whole Lakey killing again, pick at it as if it were a scab, peel and pick and pluck at it to see if the wound was healed underneath. And of course that was a waste of time and emotional resources, for both of them knew already that it wasn't healed and never would be. Dan said, "After Dunbar shot me there on the front lawn of the Lakey house, I suppose that was my fault too," Mondale said. "No," Dan said, "I shouldn't have tried to rush him. I didn't think he'd use the gun, and I was wrong. But after he shot me, Ross, he was stunned for a moment, stupefied by what he'd done, and he was vulnerable."
"Bullshit! He was as vulnerable as a runaway Sherman tank. He was a maniac, a flat-out lunatic. And he had the biggest goddamn pistol, a .32," Dan corrected. "There are bigger guns. Every cop comes up against bigger guns than that, all the time. And he was vulnerable for a moment, plenty long enough for you to take the son of a bitch." "You know one thing I always hated about you, Haldane?"
Ignoring him, Dan said, "But you ran. I always hated that wide, wide streak of self-righteousness. If he'd wanted to, Dunbar could have put another slug in me. No one to stop him after you ran off behind the house. As if you never made a mistake in your goddamn life." They were both almost whispering now. "But instead he walked away from me. As if you were never afraid. And he shot the lock off the front door. You want to play the hero? Go ahead. You and Audie Murphy. You and Jesus Christ. And he went inside and pistol-whipped Fran Lakey. I hate your guts. And then made her watch. You make me sick. While he killed the one person in the world she really loved, Dan said. He was being relentless now because there was no way to stop until it had all been said. He wished he had never begun. Wished he'd left it buried, but now that he had started, he had to finish. Because he was like the ancient mariner in that old poem. Because he had to purge himself of an unrelenting nightmare, because he was driven to follow it to the end. Because if he stopped in the middle, the unsaid part would be as bitter as a big wad of vomit in his throat, unheaved, wedged there, and he'd choke on it. Because, and here it was, here was the truth of it, no easy euphemisms this time. After all these years, his own soul was still shackled to a ball of guilt that had been weighing him down since the death of the Lakey child. And maybe if he finally talked about it with Ross Mondale, he might find a key that would release him from that iron ball, those chains. The radio was at full volume again. And each word exploded like one round of a cannonade. Blood coming. Run. More urgently than she had spoken before, afraid of what might be coming, wanting Melanie to be on her feet and ready to flee, Laura said, Honey, get up. Come on. From the radio, Hide. And it. And coming. The volume grew louder. It. Jarring. Ear-splitting. Loose. Earl put his hand on the volume knob. It. At once Earl jerked his hand off the knob as if he had taken an electric shock. He looked at Laura, horrified. He vigorously wiped his hand on his shirt. It hadn't been an electric shock that had sizzled through him. Instead, he had felt something weird when he touched the knob. Something disgusting. Repulsive. The radio said, Deaf. Mondale's hatred was a dark and vast swamp into which he could retreat when the uncomfortable truth about Cindy Lakey rose to haunt him. As the truth drew nearer and pressed upon him more insistently, he withdrew farther into his all-encompassing black hatred and hid there amid the snakes and bugs and muck of his psyche. He continued to glare at Dan, to loom threateningly over the desk, but there was no danger that his hatred would propel him to action. He would not throw a single punch. He didn't need or want to relieve his hatred by striking out at Dan. Instead, he needed to nurture that hatred, for it helped him to hide from responsibility. It was a veil between him and the truth, and the heavier that veil, the better for him. That was how Mondale's mind worked. Dan knew him well, knew how he thought. But though Ross might try to hide from it, the truth was that Felix Dunbar had shot Dan, and Mondale had been too scared to return the fire. The truth was that Dunbar then went inside the Lakey house, pistol-whipped Fran Lakey, and shot 8-year-old Cindy Lakey 3 times, while Ross Mondale was God knew where, doing God knew what. And the truth was that, wounded and bleeding badly, Dan had retrieved his own gun, crawled into the Lakey house, and killed Felix Dunbar before Dunbar could blow off Fran Lakey's head, too. All the while, Ross Mondale was maybe puking in the shrubbery or losing control of his bladder, or sprawled flat on the rear lawn and striving hard to look like a natural feature of the landscape. He had come back when it was all over, sweat damp and slug white, shaky, reeking of the sour smell of cowardice. Now, still behind Joseph Scaldone's desk, Dan said, You try forcing me off this case, or you try keeping me out of the action, and I'll tell the whole rotten story about the Lakey shootings, the truth, to anyone who'll listen, and that'll be the end of your dazzling career. With a smugness that would have been infuriating if it hadn't been so boringly predictable, Mondale said, If you were going to tell anyone, you'd have told them years ago. That must be a comforting thought, Dan said. But it's wrong. I covered for you then because you were my partner. And I figured everyone has a right to screw up once. But I've lived to regret the way I handled it, and if you give me a good excuse, I'd enjoy setting the record straight. It all happened a long time ago, Mondale said. You think no one cares about dereliction of duty just because it happened 13 years ago? No one will believe you. They'll think it's sour grapes. I've moved up. Made friends.
Yeah.
And they're the kind of friends who'd sell their mothers for lunch money.
You've always been a loner. A wise ass. No matter what you think of them, I have people who'll rally around me.
With a lynching rope.
Power makes people loyal, Haldane. Even if they'd rather not be. Nobody'll believe any crap you care to throw at me. Not a rotten wise ass like you. Not a chance.
Ted Garvey will believe me, Dan said. And if he had spoken any more quietly, he would have been inaudible. Yet in spite of his quiet delivery, he might as well have swung a hammer at Mondale instead of those 5 words. The captain looked stricken. Garvey, 10 years their senior, was a veteran patrolman and had been Mondale's partner during his probationary rookie year. He had seen Mondale make a few mistakes, although nothing as serious as what happened at the Lakey House later, when Dan had replaced Garvey as Mondale's partner. Just disquieting errors of judgment. A too meager sense of responsibility. Garvey had thought he detected cowardice in Ross, too, but had covered up for him, just as Dan would do in times to come. Garvey was a big, gruff, easygoing guy, three-quarters Irish, with too much sympathy for rookies. He hadn't given Mondale high ratings in his rookie year. The Irishman was good-natured and sympathetic, but not irresponsible. But he didn't give Mondale really bad ratings, either, because he was too soft-hearted for that. A few months after the Lakey incident, when Dan was back at work with a new partner, Ted Garvey had come around, quietly feeling Dan out, dropping hints, worried that he had made a serious mistake in covering up for Ross. Eventually they had swapped information and discovered they had both been misguidedly shielding Mondale. They realized his misconduct was not just a rare or even a sometime thing. But by then it had seemed too late to come forth with the truth. In the eyes of the department brass, Garvey's and Dan's failure, even temporary failure, to report Mondale's dereliction of duty, would be nearly as bad as that dereliction itself. Garvey and Dan would have found themselves standing in the dock beside Mondale. They weren't prepared to damage or perhaps even destroy their own careers. Besides, by then Mondale had wheedled an assignment to the Community Relations Division. He was no longer working on the street. Garvey and Dan figured Ross would do well in community relations and would never return to a regular beat, in which case he would never again be in a position to hold someone else's life in his hands. It seemed best and safest to leave well enough alone. Neither of them imagined that Mondale would one day be a serious contender for the chief's office. Maybe they would have taken action if they could have foreseen the future. Their failure to act was the thing that both of them most regretted in all their years of service. Clearly, Mondale had not known that Garvey and Dan had compared notes. Their consultation was a nasty shock to him. The radio boomed. It. Coming. Hyde. Coming. The disconnected words exploding from the Sony were impossibly loud, delivered with considerably more volume than the speakers were capable of providing. Thunderous. Volcanic. Wall-shaking. The speakers should have disintegrated or burned out as those tremendous bursts of sound smashed through them, but they continued to function. The radio vibrated against the counter. Loose. Coming. Each word crashed through Laura and seemed to pulverize more of her self-control. Panic and fear surged through her. The kitchen lights pulsed, dimmed. At the same time, the green glow that illuminated the radio dial became brighter, unnaturally bright, as if the Sony had acquired both a consciousness and a greedy thirst for electricity, as if it were drawing off all available power for itself. But that didn't make sense, because regardless of how much power the radio received, the dial was still equipped with a low-wattage bulb that couldn't produce this brilliant glow. Yet it did, as the ceiling lights grew dimmer, still dazzling emerald beams sprayed out through the plexiglass panel in the front of the radio, painting Earl Benton's face, glinting off the chrome on the stove and refrigerator, imparting to the air a rippling murkiness. The room seemed to be underwater. Ripping. Apart. The air was freezing. Tearing. Apart. Laura didn't understand that portion of the message, unless it was a threat of physical violence. The Sony was vibrating faster than the stones in a rattlesnake's rattle. Soon it would be bouncing across the counter. Splitting. In. Two. Dan said, "If I go public, Ted Garvey probably will too, and maybe there's even someone else out there who's seen you at your worst, Ross. Maybe they'll come forward when we do. Maybe they'll have a conscience too." Judging by the expression on Mondale's face, there evidently was someone else who could blow his career out of the water. He was no longer smug when he said, "One cop never rats on another, damn it." "Nonsense. If one of us is a killer, we don't protect him." "I'm no killer," Mondale said. "If one of us is a thief, we don't protect him. I've never stolen a goddamn dime. And if one of us is a coward who wants to be chief, we have to stop protecting him, too, before he gets into the front office and plays fast and loose with other men's lives, the way some cowards do when they get enough power to be above the fight themselves. You take the goddamn cake. You're the snottiest, most self-satisfied son of a bitch I've ever seen." "Coming from you, I'll take that as a compliment." "You know the code. It's us against them." "Why, for heaven's sake, Ross. Just a minute ago you told me it was always every man for himself." Irrationally trying to separate his own conduct at the Lakey house from the code of honor that he now so strenuously professed to embrace, Mondale could do no more than repeat himself. "It's us against them, damn it." Dan nodded. "Yes. But when I say us, I don't include you. You and I can't possibly belong to the same species." "You'll destroy your own career," Mondale said. "Maybe. Definitely. The Internal Affairs Division is going to want to know why the hell you covered up this so-called dereliction of duty." "Misguided allegiance to another man in uniform. That won't be good enough." "We'll see." "They'll have your ass for breakfast." Dan said, "You're the one who actively screwed up. My moral irresponsibility was a passive act, passive sin. They might suspend me for that, reprimand me, but they're not going to throw me off the force because of it." "Maybe not. But you'll never get another promotion." Dan shrugged. "Doesn't matter. I've gone as far as I really care to. Ambition doesn't rule me, Ross, the way it does you." "But no one will trust you after you've done a thing like this." "Sure they will." "No, no, not after you've ratted on another cop." "If the cop was anyone but you, that might be true." Mondale bristled. "I have friends." "You're well liked by the high brass," Dan said, "because you always tell them what they want to hear. You know how to manipulate them. But the average cop on the beat thinks you're a jerk-off." "Bullshit. I have friends everywhere. You'll be frozen out, isolated, shunned." "Even if that's true, and it isn't, so what? I'm just a loner anyway, remember? You said so yourself. You said I'm a loner. What do I care if I'm shunned?" For the first time, more worry than hatred was evident in Ross Mondale's face. "You see?" Dan said. He smiled again, more broadly than before. "You don't have any choice. You have to let me work on this case the way I want to work on it, without any interference, just as long as I want. If you mess with me, I'll destroy you. So help me God, even if it means problems for me too." The overhead lights grew even dimmer, but the radio's eerie green radiance was now so bright that it hurt Laura's eyes. "Stop. Help. Run. Hide. Help." The plexiglass that shielded the radio dial suddenly cracked down the middle. The Sony vibrated so violently that it began to move across the counter. Laura remembered the nightmarish image that had come to her a few minutes ago, crab-like legs sprouting from the plastic casing. The refrigerator door flew open again, all by itself. With a hiss and squeak of hinges, with scattered thumping sounds, every cupboard door in the room abruptly and simultaneously flung itself wide open. One of them banged against Earl's legs, and he almost fell. The radio had stopped emitting selected words from various stations. Now it was simply spewing out a